The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Okay, well, good morning again. We will have opportunity for questions and so on, so please feel free to write any down that you may have. I'll do what I can with them. But I do want to begin by saying I'm pretty upset as a Scotsman, because I've just made a discovery this morning, and you'll understand why I'm upset if you understand the stereotypes of Scotsmen. I've just discovered that if you get on the train before 7 o'clock, it's like $1.20 cheaper. And I did not know this. And to think of the number of times I've gone on the train at 7:05. So, can I please ask if you've got any other tips along these lines? It would be enormously helpful. After 6:30 as well. Okay, no, I'm not staying that late. Sorry, Mr. Calder. But I like getting up early in the morning. I was thinking, and you get a seat on the train then as well. It's very interesting the way that Christianity is tried to be portrayed with most people. And it, in effect, goes like this, both in our press and elsewhere. And I think it's a false view. And here in this one, I share very much the view of the more militant atheists like Richard Dawkins and others. I agree with them in their analysis. Most people want to portray Christianity as being like, if you belong to a church, it's like belonging to a line dancing club or a knitting club or something like that, that is relatively harmless as long as you don't disturb anyone else. Whereas in reality, Christianity is quite revolutionary. Dawkins calls it a virus that needs to be eradicated, which is very dangerous language. But in a way, he's quite right. And the passage we looked at, I just wanted to think about the impact of real Christianity on a city, on a firm, on so many different things, on families and so on. And that is the expression that we find. Oh, by the way, Third Space Espresso. We've set up something called Third Space, and we're really having an impact on the city already. They've started naming coffee shops after us. So I'm looking forward to the Third Space Stadium fairly soon, and a posh restaurant as well. But I want to go to this verse here. These men who've caused trouble all over the world have now come here. Now, I studied history at the University of Edinburgh, and in particular, I had two specialities. One was Weimar Germany, but the other was the English Civil War. And there's a Marxist historian called Christopher Hill who wrote a fascinating book called The World Turned Upside Down. And he was describing the impact of the Puritans and what he called radical Christians. I guess today, in Scottish terms, I was once accused of being a member of the Tartan Taliban. I'm not quite sure what we were supposed to be doing, but it was Hill's way of saying these people really did turn the world upside down, and he took it from Acts 17, verse 6, in the old King James Version. These people who have turned the world upside down have come here also. And I love that verse. And in fact, when I was a student in seminary, we were asked to go and preach in different places. And I always preached on that verse until I discovered that the NIV version of it, which is the one up there, these men who've caused trouble all over the world have now come here also. And it is my motto. It's my motto for in Sydney as well. And it's not a bad thing to be known as a troublemaker if it's for good reasons. I think Christianity does have that impact. We have an expression in Scots which goes like this. He's harmless, harmless. So, you know, it's like the eccentric person who stands on the street's corner and shouts at people as they go by. They're harmless, you know, let them be. But someone whose words have impact, someone whose teaching begins to change things, they're not harmless. That's why for those of you who are Christians, when you pray that your church would do well, be careful what you pray for, because if you begin to have an impact, you will find that the opposition is enormous. And I think that's what happened here. Now, how did they turn the world upside down? Did they do marches? Were they involved in politics? Were they kind of, you know, terrorist organizations? Well, I mean, what did they do? And what is quite remarkable when you look at the New Testament is that it was a group of men and of women who, in effect, traveled throughout the Mediterranean, the Roman world. They were able to do so because of the Roman roads and because of what was called the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. And they went to places and they taught people about Jesus. And you would say, okay, fair enough. You know, that's one of these weird religions. You know, I don't object, for example, to the Falun Gong being outside St. Andrew's Cathedral every day. I'll go and talk to them. I regard it as relatively harmless. I don't think it's going to change Australian society. However, Christianity had just a very, very profound and very different impact. And just the three incidences in Acts 17, I'm not going to read them all, but for me it's one of my favorite chapters in the whole Bible, and I would suggest you do look at it. The first one here is Paul had a custom, he had a tradition, went to a synagogue, and what did he do? He reasoned with them from the scriptures. And again, note a theme that I've tried to introduce or keep emphasizing. Christianity is about reason. There's a view of religion, and it's one that many Christians have, that you need to persuade people by. You get to their emotions, and then they can start thinking about things. I think that's a big mistake, because it opens people up to brainwashing, indoctrination, manipulation, and so on. I think that the Christian method was, yes, to go for the heart, if you like, to go for the will, but to do so through the head, seeking to persuade people. Again, I think it's like in a legal situation. If you as a lawyer were in court and your whole case was predicated upon the fact that you made the jury feel good about you and about your client, I think that's wrong. You really want the jury to consider facts and evidence, not how people appear, not whether they like the defendants or the prosecution witnesses or whatever. And to me, that's the same with Christianity. What Paul does is he reasons, explaining, and notice this, proving that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead. It's not Paul saying this is my opinion, it's not Paul saying this is my experience, it's Paul going into the synagogue saying, these are what the scriptures say, these are what you say you believe, now let me demonstrate to you what this means. And some, in verse 4, are persuaded. A large number of the Greeks who attended the synagogue were persuaded. And notice as well, quite a few prominent women. And what do they mean by prominent women? Almost certainly businesswomen. That's one area in that culture where women were allowed to prosper and so on. I find it quite interesting, by the way, just as an aside, that if I go to a boardroom here or something like that, it's still predominantly men. And I think there are cultural reasons for that. But in this culture, women were excluded from a lot of things, but not business, paradoxically. But they believed. But that got a reaction. And basically, it got a reaction from some of the religious people who didn't like what was happening. In this case, some of the Jewish leaders. So what they do is they go and get a mob. They weren't able to have Twitter, so they didn't start a Twitter storm. But they got a mob and they started a riot. And when they're told this, the crowd and the city officials were thrown into turmoil. They made them post bond and they, in effect, threw them out. Get out, you're causing trouble. Now, there's a second incident in this. And they go to a town called Berea. So basically, they've thrown out of one town, they go to another town. So let's just say they're in Brisbane, they're thrown out, and they go to Canberra. And the Berean Jews, it says, were of more noble character than of those in Thessalonica, for they received the message with great eagerness. But here's what they did. And again, I think, for those of you who are Christians, I'd want to encourage this. It is absolutely fundamentally antithetical to real Christianity to say to people, you've got to believe because you've got to believe. Or you've got to believe because I've say so. You are always saying to people, examine it. examine it to see if these things are true. Now, I think that is something that is crucially, crucially important. We should examine things. Now, let me give you an example. It's incredible how on the internet, and especially on social media, memes spread very, very quickly. So a number of years ago, a film was made called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. It's a great film. You'll get it on Netflix. And it's about an African kid who taught himself from books to build a windmill so that his village could have power so that they could get irrigation, pump water. And it's an extraordinary story. But for some unknown reason, in the past couple of weeks, lots and lots of people, and I think mainly Christians, to be honest, are sharing this, saying, please spread this story and make him famous because the mainstream media won't. Now, the trouble with this meme is it's completely false. The mainstream media, the BBC, made a film about it. It's published on Netflix. It's financed by Hollywood and others. And it's just a completely false meme. But people automatically spread it. And one of the things I've tried to encourage people to do is say, don't just pass on what you read. Examine it to see if it's true. So I once put out a tweet, which I still can't believe that this actually happened. I said, as Thomas Jefferson said, don't believe everything you read on the internet. And people retweeted it. Did Jefferson really say that? I'm sorry, I want to despair at how dumbed down our culture has become, where sarcasm and irony are completely missed out, where you have to explain everything in great detail. But it's, for me, it's a fundamental principle. Examine. Now, that works both ways. If you're an atheist, if you're a Buddhist, if you're a Hindu, if you're a Muslim, whatever your religion, whatever your philosophy, whatever your belief, it should be subject to examination. That is, for me, absolutely crucial. The unexamined life, I think it was Socrates said this, is an unlived life. And right, I mean, we don't want to be introspective all the time, but we want to examine. And here they are, they're examining the scriptures every day to see if what Paul says was true. So we've got the first principle, which is that real Christianity is revolutionary. It turns the world upside down. It will turn your family upside down. It turns your company upside down. It turns society upside down. I was very, very impressed to be at the National Prayer Breakfast on Monday. And to be honest, I was stunned at the difference between Australia and the UK. I'll say this. You know, your opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, he was vague and fairly clueless, I think, about Christianity, but very nice and spoke well. And I was just intrigued that he was there and that he spoke. Your prime minister was, I think, much more biblical and quite courageous, I thought, in some ways. But the man who completely blew my mind away was, I think, is it the governor general? Is that what you call him? The governor general, who I thought, that guy is really sound. And then I discovered that he was a Presbyterian. I thought, no wonder he's sound. No. I was just so impressed. And I thought, you know, it's not that you need people in high positions, but basically everyone, wherever you are, there's an impact that's made. And it does turn the world upside down. So you've got that. You've got the need to examine. And then Paul goes on to Athens. And it's possibly, I think, my favorite story. I couldn't get the photograph, but I stood at the Areopagus, at the place where Paul made this speech. And what got me about it, what gets me about Paul's speech, and again, I won't read it all, but just to summarize it, he stands up and basically all the philosophers, all the politicians, this is where they gather to debate and discuss. And it actually says that this is where they gather to debate and discuss the latest ideas. And it's the ultimate third space, if you like. And he stands there. And first of all, he does something really interesting. He connects with them. He said, I've wandered around your city and I see you've got lots of statues. In fact, it was rumored that Athens had more statues to gods than it had people. And he said, I see you've got this. I see you've got one to an unknown god. Now I'm going to tell you about this unknown god. So he connected with them straight away. He quoted their philosophers and poets, which again is fascinating. It shows that he knew them. He also was incredibly brave. And I only understood this when I went there. because the Areopagus is this, and the Parthenon are these massive buildings that in today's terms cost billions. You know, forget your casino on the waterfront. This was just going to cost 10 times that. And these people had spent billions doing this. And Paul stands there, this short Jewish man, probably with a hooked nose, not able to speak all that well, apparently. And he describes, I mean, he's always described as unimpressive in any reckoning we have of him. And he stands there and he says to them, you see that temple? The God who lives, who created heaven and earth and everyone, the God who made you, doesn't live in a temple made by human hands. And he's basically saying to them, you guys have wasted your money. It's incredibly brave. But the way he says it and the way he does it, they listen and they listen and they listen until he gets to this point. And the point is when he talks about the resurrection of the dead. Immediate response, sneering, but a few, not many, a few, including one prominent woman, said, probably again a businesswoman, said, we want to hear you more about this. We want to hear more. We want to find out more. And you'll see what's happening. Paul is teaching something that's revolutionary, that's upsetting, that turns their world upside down. He's asking them to examine it. He's showing himself to be learned in their culture. And he's still proclaiming something that to them appears self-evidently ridiculous. Dead people do not rise. And yet he does it, and it has an impact upon some. The wise examine it. The others sneer and ignore it. My fear today is that we live in a culture where people don't examine things, where we dismiss things according to our culture or to our emotions. And I want to encourage you to think about things and to question and ask. But not to question in the sense of you're like the ultimate barrister or judge who gets to determine what is truth. You're actually trying to find out the truth, not to create it and not to create your own world. And I'm maybe this is old-fashioned, but I think this is absolutely essential. If there's no such thing as truth, we are all massively confused. We are all in a mess. But there is such a thing as truth, and ultimately I believe that truth is in Jesus, and he's the one who turns the world upside down. Yeah, I have one. Okay, I've got a couple. What would you say to someone who says you should examine all of the other religions before believing the gospel? I would say go ahead, but there's 30,000, so you're going to struggle a wee bit. But I would certainly say do the main ones. I mean, I, for example, have read the Quran. You can read a little bit of the Hindu scriptures. You certainly can't read them all. I don't know of any Hindu who would have read them all. I think it's fairly easy to examine the main religions and to work out the differences. So, I mean, if people are that way inclined, I would encourage them to do so. Do we know just how Paul was proving that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead? Well, we know partly because he was using the scriptures. And the tradition in the synagogues was for people to read part of the scriptures and then someone would come up and explain it. It was very open. And Paul would be recognized as a teacher. So what he would be doing is he would be quoting, for example, from Isaiah 53, from some of the Psalms, from some of the prophecies. I do not understand in order to believe. Instead, I believe in order that I might understand. Isn't that the usual way people come to faith, or at the very least, a legitimate pathway to faith? That's Augustine. And if you read Augustine's Confessions, which I would strongly advise you to do, one of the greatest books that's ever written, it starts off and you think, oh, this is quite easy. And then it just gets, it gets really heavy philosophy, but brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I would say this, Augustine never says, just believe. The reason he writes his Confessions is to provide evidence. What he's saying in that quote is not, right, I only believe what I can understand. He's saying, this is where the evidence goes. This is what I'm going to accept. And because I accept it, it's very much like getting married. You know, let's say you were old-fashioned and you said, I'm not going to have sex before marriage. And you decide, you get to a point where the two of you are think you can live together for the rest of your life and you get married. Well, the fact that you then get married, you then experience the marital bliss or otherwise that goes with that. You don't say, the kind of reverse the order doesn't make sense. So there's a sense in which when you make the commitment, you understand so much more. But in order to make the commitment, you have to have sufficient evidence that you're prepared to commit yourselves. There's a kind of, in other words, what I'm saying is the Bible doesn't teach us to have blind faith. When it said they examined the scriptures, what it is that they were reading? The Old Testament. Do we all need mentors to guide us through life? No, not really. We need friends. We need family. We need people. You may need a mentor in a particular thing. You know, what's a mentor? For me, I need friends. I don't need somebody who's kind of, well, they're one level above me in the path to enlightenment. I do think there's a fad in churches to have mentors, and I think that's not a bad thing to have somebody, but I'm probably a bit more egalitarian than that. Do you believe that free speech, freedom of thought, and dissent are consistent with faith? Oh, absolutely. I think that free speech ultimately comes from freedom of religion, and I would argue this. Christianity was the first religion in the world that did not seek to coerce worship. In other words, it insisted that worship must be free. In other words, from your heart. Now, Christians, or professing Christians, or people who have used Christianity, have often gone against that. But coerced worship is by definition not worship. And that was very, very strongly thought. I think freedom of speech and freedom of thought is right, but I also think freedom of speech, you can say things that are wrong, and freedom of thought, you can be an idiot. You have the freedom to be that, but other people have the freedom to point it out as well. There was another question that I was asked about in terms of the Red Sea. No, sorry, I wanted to do this one just because I think it's quite important. It doesn't sound important. But there's every now and then you get a documentary on television where people go, this is really radical, and it's not really radical. You know what would be really radical on television? It would be someone did a documentary that said, actually, this shows the Bible was right. That would be really radical television. But when I hear this is really radical, I almost know what's going to happen. And there was a documentary recently which said something along the lines of, the Israelites didn't go through the Red Sea. That's a misreading. It was the Reed Sea. Because it was the Sea of Reeds, and the reeds parted, not the water, and all that kind of stuff. And say, well, you know, is that a historical fact? This is where you've got to, when you're looking at evidence, all the time you're looking at the prejudices. The presupposition of the people who make that up is based purely on this. Miracles don't happen, therefore this didn't happen, therefore we need to respect what was written, but we need to find another interpretation. So Jesus walked in the water. No, he didn't. It was a sandbank. Jesus multiplied the 5 loaves and 2 fish, or was it the 2 loaves and 5 fish? I never remember. The 5 loaves and 2 fish, I think. And no, he didn't, because what happened was everyone was being greedy and they hid their packed lunches. And then this wee boy gave his, and everyone saw how generous he was. And so they all shared theirs, and that's how everyone. And the people who do that are basically saying, because we don't believe there are miracles, we have to find another explanation. And that's an example of that. Because historically, it is very difficult both to prove and disprove anything from more than 1,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago. Very little written evidence, some archaeological evidence. And you can almost make archaeology say whatever you want. I'll just give you one example. Recently, there have been a couple of articles, I think one in National Geographic and elsewhere, saying the pyramids were not built by slaves, as the Bible says. We found evidence that it was employed manual laborers, skilled laborers. But when you dig down deeper, you realize, sorry for the twisted analogy, but when you dig down deeper, you find that what's happened is there is evidence of skilled labor who were the supervisors, but there's also substantive evidence that slaves were used to build the pyramids. So always be very careful when someone says history has shown that. I'm back to this. Examine, question, and look at. Okay, I think some of you probably have work to go and do your own examining. Thank you very much, and hopefully we'll see you next week.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.